Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. We are joined today by Amod Lely, who teaches Indian philosophy at Boston University. He is also visiting researcher at the Centre for the Study of Asia and educational technologist with Information Services and Technology. He writes a regular blog in cross-cultural philosophy called Love of All Wisdom, on which I recently encountered a post he wrote entitled Little Conservatism, and this will be the topic of our discussion today. Hello, Amod. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, Barry. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're welcome. Okay. Well, could you perhaps begin, Amod, by telling us a bit about yourself and your interest in the topic? Why did you choose to write this article? It was a few years ago now, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was 2010, so going on 7 years. So I'm not entirely sure I can say why I picked that particular topic back then, but it was something that I thought was worthy of saying, because I think there's something really important to the idea of conservatism in the sense that is literally implied by the word of conserving, the way in which there is the etymological relationship between conservatism and conservation, trying to preserve things the way that they are, in a way that includes both environmentalism and preserving existing social relations. And I would never say I've entirely identified as completely conservative in all these respects, but it's something that I have a lot of sympathy for. Perhaps identified above all with the idea that revolutions are bad. Other things being equal, at least, revolutions are bad. And there's some priority that is valuable to attach to the status quo, because disruptions cause so much grief to people who are used to the existing state of affairs and plan their lives around it and make things work that way. And this is not to say change is bad. It's also not even necessarily to say that the existing state of affairs is good, just that the fact that a new state of affairs is better than the existing state is not necessarily enough to merit all of the costs imposed in the transition. And I think, you know, I took on my job as an educational technologist, which is my main way of making a living, since after I wrote that post. I teach in the philosophy department on the side. But that work as an educational technologist has actually, in some ways, confirmed my ideas in the value of literal conservatism, in this field, we are constantly hearing about so-called disruptive innovation, which people often take as being a good thing, and I tend to think of as bad, especially just in the way that academia has worked. You know, if we look at the most dramatic changes that the university system has experienced, at least in North America, during my lifetime, there are really two changes that have been the largest and the most disruptive and the most far-reaching. One is the adjunctification of the labor force, the kind of reduction of people, of instructors from full-time faculty to part-time positions with no benefits, which, you know, in the U.S. can mean no health care. Yeah. And the other is the dramatic increase in tuitions, to the point that I believe a Boston University student now will pay at least $40,000, possibly $50,000 US a year to go here.
Wow.
These are both dramatic changes. They are disruptive innovations, and I think they are entirely for the worse. You know, we are also dealing with a situation where the focus of the university has moved away from the humanities and social sciences and natural sciences to career-oriented fields, and the mission of the university is increasingly viewed as being something oriented towards preparing students for a job rather than towards making them more cultivated people and better informed citizens. So this is a background for the fact that as technologists, our daily work is trying to help faculty teach better using new tools that are available. And I think that's a perfectly noble vocation, and I wouldn't be in it if I didn't think that. But to me, that is about taking the things that faculty have always done and helping them do them better. Whereas there is this, a widespread view that what we should be doing is disrupting everything and you know, having this kind of Silicon Valley startup culture that says, you know, let's knock everything down and start it back up again and build it up from the ground up. And I think if that were really to happen in the university, that everything was going to be knocked down and built back up again, there'd be no place for the humanities at all. There'd be no place for tenured professors. There'd be no place for anything that I find valuable about the university, and I would no longer want part of it. And so, you know, as technologists, we often encounter resistance from professors who, you know, really don't want to do anything different. They don't want to change their ways. And that can be bad as well as good. You know, they're often used to a pedagogy that's entirely lecture-based, you know, kind of reading their notes at people, which has never been a very effective way to teach. And, you know, we often have justifiable frustration at that. But for me, that's always tempered by saying, well, you know, there are a lot of ways in which the fact that universities keep doing things the old ways is a good thing. You know, I'd rather have universities as they were in the 1950s or before, warts and all, than have this new vision that the Silicon Valley disruptors who want to unbundle everything and, you know, have people take everything by the courts want. So all of that makes me feel there is really something to be gained by an attitude that is literally conservative in that sense of assigning some value to the status quo.
And so just to sort of go back to the roots of this way of thinking, I'm thinking of Edmund Burke. What did conservatism mean in the time of Edmund Burke? By many is considered to be the father of conservatism.
Right. I don't mean to count myself as a Burke expert by any means. I'm not all that familiar with his thought. I am basically going on a kind of educated layperson's knowledge of it.
Sure.
You know, I may not know it any better than you do, but I have thought that there is a kind of commonality that what Burke was always insisting on was the importance of local communities, the little platoons that form local neighborhoods and their existing ways of doing things, and thought that something very bad was happening when the French Revolution radically disrupted everything and you know, tried to start everything from year zero. And I think you know, Burke may be right about that. You know, I mean, there even at that point there would have been different kinds of conservatism. Burke's variety of conservatism would have been very different from Joseph de Maistre, who said there is an eternal order of throne and altar that should not be disrupted. And I have not a lot of sympathy for that view. But I think that maybe this sort of moves into some later questions, is that in the time of the revolution, you know, the idea of progressive or radical versus conservative matched up fairly well with left versus right.
Right.
In that the changes that were being made were changes in an egalitarian direction. And that's how I tend to understand the left versus right axis, is that left-wingers want to promote equality, or they want society to be more equal, and right-wingers want it to be less equal in terms of kind of substantive outcome equality, not just equality of legal right.
Yeah.
Although in the days of the French Revolution, even equality of legal right was something of its own revolution. And so I think one of the things that really sort of led me to the idea of literal conservatism really was sort of realizing that in the course of my lifetime, I was born in 1976, the engines of change have mostly been on the right, that the revolutionary energy has been from people like Reagan and Thatcher and George W. Bush, who wanted to slash taxes, slash regulations, and create a world drastically different from the one that had existed in 1976, and succeeded in a lot of this and made a lot of far-reaching changes. And one of the things that sort of crystallized it for me, and I think I mentioned that in an original blog post, in Ontario, where I'm from, in the 90s, the premier of the province had this scheme where they would take all of the crown land, the public land, and sort of take a large portion of it to make it parkland, and then sell the rest to developers. So it was kind of the largest amount of parkland ever made. So we'll conserve this as parkland, and then everything else gets sold off. That was sort of the scheme, basically sort of saying, like, you know, let's not have this kind of general crown land that exists in a public way anymore. Let's rationalize it all and either make it specifically park or make it something developable. And similarly, you know, they slashed levels of government in order to save money. There used to be a county level of government that they got rid of, and they merged small local city governments into giant governments full of millions of people. And I think this is something that would have horrified Burke, you know, that moves away from neighborhoods and communities. But this was something that, to me, is extremely unconservative, that it's not conserving anything, it's changing everything, but it is right-wing, and because it's right-wing, it has gone by the name of conservatism. Whereas conversely, the left in those years really was basically the group that tried to conserve the welfare state that had comfortably existed in the mid-century, and to resist the radical changes put out by the Reaganite and Thatcherite right. Now, there may be some signs that that's changing nowadays. Just in the past year or two, we're in a very unusual, well, or at least a very new political situation. I think nobody quite knows where that is. I was supportive of Bernie Sanders' political campaign in the U.S., and a friend of mine pushed me on this. He said, you know, I think you can't really be the literal conservative that you sometimes say you are, if you support Sanders, when, you know, Sanders explicitly describes what he wants to do as a revolution. He refers to our revolution. And I thought about that for a while after he said that. I thought, you know, maybe he's right. Maybe I'm not a conservative in this literal sense. But I've gone back and forth on that, and I think I actually do find it quite possible to recognize, or to reconcile rather, literal conservatism with support for Sanders, just on the simple basis that when he says it's a revolution, I don't really believe him. That I think the changes being proposed are not that radical. That including things like having a significantly higher minimum wage and subsidizing university tuition are not very big changes. A move to a national single-payer health care might be a bit more drastic. But on the other hand, I think Barack Obama's health care plan was a very conservative one in some ways, because it was really trying to work with the existing system, the existing providers that were there. But we've seen just how difficult that's been to implement, both politically and logistically, in a way that's actually fair and effective. And, you know, it may be the case that it is better to make that a kind of wider, to go all the way to a single payer system. On the other hand, you know, and where I think the liberal conservatism idea may have some power in my thought still is, I'm a lot more skeptical of Jeremy Corbyn than I am of Sanders. I think he is considerably more radical than Sanders is, in terms of his disregard for some of the longstanding foreign policy alliances and agreements, his readiness to nationalize a lot of services that are currently provided by the private sector, not just in healthcare, but beyond that. And in addition, his past support for the IRA. Those things make me nervous, and I think that's a conservative impulse to be concerned about that.
Okay. It's interesting. I actually voted, most of my life I voted for progressive parties, but I do find this idea of literal conservative resonant in many ways, partly the idea that it's based on pragmatism, on the tried and tested, on the recognition that we are finite beings, we're imperfect. But I've recently aligned myself with the policies of Corbyn. For the last few years, I've been a member of the Green Party. And it's created a sort of dilemma for me in a little way, because I do recognise that some of his policies don't cohere with that particular worldview, the literal conservative view. However, I think sometimes there are situations where we're actually crying out for change. And it's not that literal conservatism doesn't agree with change, as you said at the beginning. So my question is, when things do seem to have gone out of kilter, which from my personal political perspective they have, in terms of just social justice, whether the whole idea of austerity, I think, is quite a radical act which we're pursuing in the UK. So how does that philosophy, if we could call it one, engender change?
I think maybe the one word answer would be slowly. I think there are ways in which a literal conservative can recognize, you know, the existing order that seems to have worked well is threatened by such a way that some sort of drastic change does need to happen and happen rapidly. And I think environmental issues are one of the are the most obvious example of that. That, you know, if you would like to see 100 years from now a world that is as much like the world that exists now as possible, then you need to put in some pretty drastic changes and regulations to make sure that the way things are going, the direction things are moving in, does not continue, because it is unsustainable. I think anyone who aspires to be conservative in the literal sense should aim for sustainability in all senses of that word. Now, I think that there's a somewhat different case when it comes to social justice, because in that case we are kind of faced with situations where, you know, we might generally say, like, the status quo is perfectly sustainable, but we still think it's worth changing.
Yeah.
And I think there are situations like that, and it's in part because I do think there are situations like that that I'm not quite willing to go all the way in calling myself a literal conservative.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in my original blog post on the subject, I quoted Martin Luther King, because I think he speaks perhaps more eloquently than anybody against literal conservatism in that particular respect. Sort of, you know, that I think, you know, one could have at the time said, you know, all right, we recognize that there are some injustices here and we want to rectify them, but we don't want to disrupt things too much, so let's have them move slowly. And many people did say that to King, and quite explicitly, and he is writing explicitly in response to them. You know, that he typically refers to them as the white moderate. And he's saying, you know, look, I think I have a quote on my screen right here. Perhaps it's easy for those who have never felt the stinging dark of segregation to say, wait, but when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers in will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you've seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, when you see the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, and it goes on for quite a long time, closing with, when you know forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. There comes a time when the cup of endurance runs over and men are no longer willing to be plunged into the abyss of despair. I hope, sirs, you can understand our legitimate and unavoidable impatience. And, you know, I find it pretty hard to argue with King against that kind of view. In the context of his particular situation, I think the trick about it is that, you know, it's such a beautiful statement that people can be ready to quote it in regards to just about any kind of cause, whatever, even though it's the causes for which it's quoted are typically situations where the situation that people are in are not nearly as bad as the one that African Americans faced in the South. But, you know, there's always a balancing act. I think with anything, you know, there are multiple sides to every issue. You know, I think there are There are particular cases where it's clear that, that one side is right and one side is wrong, but I don't think, you know, it's typically a bad idea to say something is right or wrong on general principle without assessing the various factors that lead to the situation or that constitute the particular situation.
You just said there that there's always a balancing act. Now, the middle way, as we understand it, is the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things, whether those are positive or negative. That then arguably throws us back on experience, so we're less in this sort of messy, uncertain middle. But could be said that it's the messy, uncertain middle where we can actually start to get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter. Now, how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
I think there's a fairly strong relationship. In some of the other posts I've made, I've talked about philosophical single-mindedness as a sort of sense of kind of putting everything in the service of one single principle, and that in a way that goes beyond politics, although it is particularly notable in politics. Single-mindedness I see as the kind of thing that characterizes communism, certainly, but also militant Islam of the Wahhabi stripe, especially, and certain strains of libertarianism as well, the kind of libertarianism associated recently in the U.S. with Paul Ryan and the Tea Party, and perhaps especially Ron Paul and Rand Paul that says, you know, less government is always best. And I think part of the appeal of liberal conservatism is that it's not subordinating things to a principle in quite the same way. I mean, I think part of the thing for Burke is that even the value of the status quo, it is kind of a principle, but its value is not in the fact that it is a principle. Its value comes from the experience that disruption is disruptive. And, you know, again, it contrasts between someone like Burke and someone like Maistre, for whom is, I think, single-minded in his own way. For Maistre, you know, there is the rule of God above the church and the church above society that kind of fixes the way things should always be eternally for all time. And I don't think, from what I've seen of Burke so far, I don't think that's his view. I think it's much more a sense that it so happens to be the case that revolutions are generally disruptive and to be avoided. And one of the reasons that they're generally to be avoided is that they tend to be in the name of a single principle that is placed above the warp and woof of everyday life.
You started off this talk, Amo, talking about education. And something's just struck me that might bring another perspective on what we've been talking about. I was a teacher for many years, and when I reflect on the times when I was in a staff room that worked really well, it tended to be where you'd got a good mix between experienced teachers and new blood. And so the experienced teachers knew inside out, the tried and tested, were perhaps a bit cautious about trying new ideas and, you know, maybe sitting on their laurels a little bit. But that mix with the new blood who come out with loads of new ideas, that sort of dialectic that happens, that synthesis, often produced a really vibrant staff room environment. Now, could that be a model also for an effective function of society as well?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, it's something I'm kind of coming to grips with now that I'm in my early 40s and sort of seeing, you know, the new generation below me in years where I think people, I see young people now thinking very differently from the way I do about a lot of issues around things like freedom of speech and the appropriateness of allowing offense. And, you know, I think I was struck by the comedian Sarah Silverman recently saying you know, she had kind of built her career on being offensive in a humorous way, and kind of gave that up in a way that I think sort of stopped making her funny, in part because she saw the way that you know what the 20-year-olds were agitating for, and she said, well, you know, the youth are always on are almost always on the right side of history. And I looked at that, I thought, that's incredibly myopic. You know, were they on the right side of history in 1917 in Russia? Were they on the were the brown shirts on the right side of history? You know, the Hitler Youth. I think what the thing is that youth are usually on the side of change. So, you know, this perspective of literal conservatism was not one that I held when I was 20. And I think there are probably very few 20-year-olds who would hold it. I mean, there's always, you know, this is the point where one usually quotes Churchill on this sorts of thing. But but I think, you know, I think your approach of the middle way is valuable in that respect. You know, even if one is taking a conservative perspective, and, you know, again, I think, you know, there are, I think there's that recognition that you know, in order to keep things the way they are, there are some things that do need to change. You know, you need to take your car for a tune-up if you want to keep the car. There is a certain way that some sort of change is inevitable and natural, and you know, at even stasis requires effort. And stasis as such is, you know, that's going to an extreme that I wouldn't appreciate it, you know, especially recognizing that there are plenty of things that are unjust in society and always have been. And, you know, I think I'm no longer at the point of thinking those injustices are going to get fixed within my lifetime or the lifetime of anybody around now. But I think that, you know, things can be better than they are, and in a lot of ways should be. But I think that there is a helpful dynamic in the 20-year-olds pushing for change as rapidly as possible and looking around and saying, that's stupid, why do we do it that way? With the people who are in their 40s and up saying, well, hold on, there actually are reasons why we do it that way, and it's actually not that stupid. And I think there is a balance to be achieved. That, yeah, I think the 20-year-olds often do bring a certain single-mindedness that if society, you know, if you did take a group of student radicals of whatever stripe and put them in charge of a society, things probably would be disastrous. But on the other hand, if you didn't have those radicals there kind of pushing for those changes, then you'd probably wind up with a situation of, you know, at best, injustices that could be fixed not getting fixed, and at worst, society really kind of stagnating and falling apart because it's not able to adapt.
Yeah. I'd just like to say one thing. I think from my perspective, at least, the middle way can often be seen as aligning quite effectively with literal conservatism, but not necessarily so, because the middle way is in many ways the position that best addresses conditions given the circumstances. But anyway, Amod, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today, and thank you for your very interesting perspective on this subject.
Thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed this, and let me know when it's up and available.
Will do.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.